I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a very special conversation with Richard Kozel Wright, one of the principal authors of a United Nations report warning of another lost decade if we repeat the same mistakes of the 07-08 financial crisis and its aftermath in our current moment of pandemic. The 2020 United Nations Conference on Trade and Development report is entitled From Global Pandemic to Prosperity, Avoiding Another Lost Decade, and warns against the allure of austerity policies, as well as showing concern for the growing climate change crisis. In my view, it's a very important report and is available on UNCTAD's website free of charge. But if you want a taste of what the report has to say, well, Richard is going to give us an overview in the following conversation. I'll let him do the explaining, though. So let's get right to the conversation with Richard Kozel Wright of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development about the United Nations report From Global Pandemic to Prosperity. Welcome to Parallax Views, Richard Kozel Wright, Director of the Globalization and Development Strategies Division in United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, and also one of the principal authors of the latest United Nations Conference on Trade and Development reports entitled From Global Pandemic to Prosperity, Avoiding Another Lost Decade. How are you doing today, Richard?
JG, I'm doing fine. Thanks for the invitation.
So I was really interested in this report, especially when it came out, I believe, in late October or early November.
September. We came out late September.
Oh, okay. It came out even earlier. It came out in September. Okay. Yeah. My apologies for mistaking that, but it was a really interesting report to read because I feel like right now we're in a very somewhat triumphalist moment for some people in America who feel that we've gotten rid of Donald Trump, who a lot of people were worried was causing disruption, not only in the US, but globally. And I think a lot of people really think that, you know, the vaccine is right around the corner and Joe Biden is going to build back better, as the slogan goes. But this report says that, you know, it may not be that simple.
Yeah, I think that's a big message from this report. I mean, obviously, our audience is particularly developing countries. We were UNCTAD as an organization that was set up largely by and for developing countries and their struggles in the global economy, but we have we're a United Nations body, so we have to talk to all members, including advanced economies. I think, you know, we and so, you know, when the crisis hit, I think we were ahead of the game, really, because already in our previous report of 2019, we had warned about serious troubles in the global economy. There were already signs of a slowdown, quite significant in advanced economies and many developing countries. Debt problems were clearly looming. Trade tensions, technology tensions were already apparent last year in the US-China spats of one kind or another. and investment was slack. There were signs already in 2019 of problems. And so when the crisis hit, we saw the potential for real serious damage. And one of the reasons we saw that was because we'd heard a lot of the, you know, when people started to kind of, you know, the lockdown was a shock to everybody. I mean, it was unprecedented, of course. We hadn't seen a self-induced policy coma, which is essentially what the lockdown was. I mean, understandable to make sure that healthcare systems somehow withstood the pressures, but that's what it was, and that was unprecedented. But as we kind of began to unwind that in the summer, and people were kind of seeing the big bounce back. You know, in the summer we were seeing very large growth rates, you know, the third quarter growth rates, you know, 20%, 25%, people were getting excited about that. Unemployment was coming down. And we said, and so, you know, then you get your rhetoric, we're going to recover better this time, we're going to build back better. And of course, we'd heard this before. We'd heard this in 2009, 2010, when after the global financial crisis, the same kind of language was being used by policymakers in the G20 and elsewhere. And as we saw that decade unfold, we saw, you know, policymakers in both the advanced and the poor and the developing countries failed to address the underlying conditions that had led to the crisis in the first place. Huge levels of inequality, weakening productivity growth. As I said, weak investment, particularly public investment, infrastructure spending in advanced economies had been flat for years, and there were problems linked to it. So all, you know, environment, the crisis, the climate crisis, of course, and no one had tackled those over the previous decade. And so unless our argument, and it's the central argument in the report, unless we have a recovering better strategy that addresses these underlying conditions, then the recovery is likely to be weak, and fragility and anxiety are going to be the kind of dominant concerns of people, you know, not only in developing countries, which have their own special problems, but also in the advanced economies too.
So in regards to how the report sort of came to be, I'm curious, what sort of research went into it? Because I think sometimes people look at reports and try to write them off as being ideological. And I don't think this type of report from UNCTAD is ideological at all. I think it references a lot of data points, and it's very much about the data.
I mean, look, everyone has some kind of ideological reference point, right? And ours, you know, as I said, we come at these kinds of problems from the particular challenges that developing countries face, right? So that's always our starting point. In the case of this report, you know, we didn't intend to write this report. I mean, you know, back in January and February of this year, we were writing a different report. And it was, you know, we had to, in a sense, retool and rethink when the pandemic hit and the lockdown happened. And we saw very quickly, damaging consequences for developing countries, often before they were hit by the health crisis, right? So in many developing countries in March, when the lockdown began, developing countries were hit very hard by, you know, a kind of capital flight, right? Investors got very nervous. There was signs of a financial panic. They began to leave emerging economies very quickly. And that triggered a very vicious cycle in developing countries, right? So capital was flying out of these countries. Exchange rates were depreciating. Interest rate spreads were rising. Exports collapsed, remittances, you know, and you get this vicious. So that hit developing countries very, very quickly and very hard. And so our initial concern was to respond, first of all, to point out the danger, because a lot of these countries had already accumulated very large debts over the period after the global financial crisis. So this kind of vicious circle becomes incredibly dangerous economically and ultimately politically for these countries. So our first point of that was our first kind of point of reference when responding to the crisis. So that's where we started back in March, thinking about the challenge from that perspective. But of course, it very quickly becomes a challenge not just for developing countries, but for advanced economies too. And ultimately, you know, with the exception of China, what happens to the world economy depends on what policymakers do still in the rich countries and in the United States in particular. So then we get into the question of what is the interaction and the relationships between within the advanced economies and then their impact on developing countries when they begin to pursue the kinds of policies that they pursue. And developing countries can't do the same, right? Developing countries don't have monetary autonomy. They have very large informal workforces. The government tax bases are much weaker. So they can't do what the United States did with the CARES Act or the European governments did in terms of throwing money at the problem, essentially. And so we then try and work out from, you know, as we go along, what are the dynamics that are unleashed by these kind of different responses and who's likely to win and who's likely to lose if we don't get this right, you know, this time around. So that's that. And, you know, and yeah, I mean, so but we are very much coming at it from a developing country perspective. And we try and use as best we can the empirical evidence that is available to us, and you know, and drawing on the research that we've done in the past, because we have, even though the shock itself, the pandemic itself, and the lockdown are unique, you know, underlying the economic dynamics in this highly financialized world have been familiar to us for, you know, two or three decades. So you know, we've done a lot of research on what happens to highly financialized economies when some kind of external shock hits them, and that's basically what we've tried to kind of follow through in the logic of the report.
I was going to say, in regards to developing countries, I think that a lot of times people overlook developing countries, or there's this sort of narrative that, capitalism as it is just lifting everyone out of poverty. I don't think it's that simple. And I think that comes out in the report, that there are these real issues arising, especially with regards to inequality.
Yeah, look, we've never drunk the neoliberal Kool-Aid in UNCTAD. That's not been our approach at all. Indeed, you know, for the last 30 years, UNCTAD has been one of the parts of the United Nations system that has consistently criticized the way in which economic and political ideology and the underlying forces behind that have been moving, you know, since the debt crisis of the early 1980s. So you know, in an earlier version of the report, back in the late 90s, actually, the Trade and Development Report was saying, look, we have a system now that is generating inequality at an unprecedented pace, when no one else was really looking at that problem, because for the reasons you said, everyone was saying, you know, it's a kind of Panglossian world in which capital is flowing everywhere and poor countries now have access to capital markets and technology will flow into the developing world and just look at China, even though China has very little to do with that kind of neoliberal ideology. That's been a dominant mantra for a long time. And then the only thing to worry about is the people who are so-called left behind, right? The very poor people who have somehow missed the boat in one way or another and are not benefiting from all these good things that hyper-globalization is delivering to them. So we've never seen that as being a very realistic way of portraying the global economy over the course of the last three or four decades.
I want to stick on that for a second, that issue of this idea of people getting left behind, and then we can get into some of the broader themes and some of the proposals in the report. But I'm not sure that it's because people are getting left behind by neoliberalism, because I think within the current system, I think inequality may be a feature rather than a bug. I want to get your thoughts on that.
No, look, I inequality is a product of the rules of the game that have been constructed over the course of the last three. People are, you know, we like to say people are not left behind in this world. They're thrown under the bus, but being thrown under a bus is a very different experience from missing the bus. That's the very different experience, very different consequences. And, you know, it's the way in which 21st century capitalism is structured and the power interests that are benefiting from that, that require the reproduction of inequality as part of the way in which the system works. And thinking of it in those terms, and you know, the way in which inequality is usually analyzed in much economic and kind of political literature is to think of it in terms of, you know, income across household groups. So, you know, we all talk about the top 1% as opposed to the bottom 99%, or the bottom 40% as compared to the top 10% of households. We tend to look at it, which is important. It's an important way of thinking about the inequality problem, of course, but I think it's very important, and we focus on this a lot in our work, on the distribution between capital, labor, and rents. A much more kind of the functional, a kind of classical political economy, actually, view of income distribution. And what has happened everywhere just about over the last 30 years is a massive reduction in the share of income going to labor and a comparable parallel increase in the share of income going to profits. And within the shift of income away from labor, there is important struggles that go on over the creation and allocation of rents, right? The use of economic power to shift income rather than create between different groups, rather than create income out of new stuff. And so we've tended to look at the distributional challenges and trends from that kind of functional income distribution. And, you know, one of the things that we've emphasized a lot, and it has particular bearings for developing countries, is the way in which very large predatory international corporations have emerged from this hyper-globalized world to be able to manipulate market forces and technologies and the things that they control to shift income in their favor and away from other sections of society. So that notion of rent seeking, of predatory types of corporate strategy, has become a very important part of the way in which we think about the inequality challenge. And talking about people being left behind doesn't really make much sense when you look at the inequality challenge from that point of view.
I noticed you use the word hyper-globalized. Why that word in particular for maybe my lay listeners? What do we mean by a hyper-globalized world?
You know, I think one of the things was that there's a kind of crass history that basically says after 1945, the world started to integrate more closely. And we've just been on this kind of continuous conveyor belt between 1945 and today.
The multilateral order, right?
Yeah, the rules-based international system. And it's just a continuous kind of process. And I think for us, what that misses is the way in which markets and capitalism were transformed in the late 1970s and the early 1980s into being a system that operated on very different rules and practices and norms from the one that emerged out of the Second World War. And central to that story is not so much the growth of international trade, which I think is how a lot of the American discourse is kind of framed, right? And it's not unimportant, the rise of NAFTA, the rise of China, etc. But far more important for that is the rise of a very footloose kind of capital that is able, unregulated, to trip around the world, kind of looking for the most profitable and often highly speculative returns that it can make by moving into and out of markets very quickly. And so it's that, I think, to try and capture that notion of a kind of footloose form of capital that had broken free from domestic regulations and from the power of organized labor, we use the term hyperglobalization in a way to kind of signal that we haven't been living a kind of continuous pattern of globalization over the last 70 years, but one that has been transformed over the course of the last three or four decades.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that, you know, I like that term you use, and it also comes up in the report, footloose capitalism, because, you know, I think there's different types of capitalism, and this one is very different from versions we've seen in the past, and I think we're in a really predatory mode. I think there's a lot of rent seeking, as you mentioned. And one thing that really interests me about this report is the discussion of austerity. And I hear that term used a lot, but I think a lot of people get confused when they hear it, or it sounds jargony, or they may hear a politician say it, but they don't know what it means. Is it a word that's sort of used to obfuscate for something else? What do we really mean by austerity, and why does it play such a central role in the report?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, for someone like myself, immersed in economic jargon, it's kind of just part of the atmosphere.
I understand that. Yeah.
But you know, I feel, look, I think most people understand that there is a line of thinking that has become very dominant in some respects. It begins in the developing world, but it is imposed on the developing world by some of the international institutions in response to the debt crises that they faced in the late 1970s and early 1980s, right, where the assumption was that, you know, govern much and irresponsibly, and what you have to do is to rebalance the economy by cutting back on everything. But everything essentially means cutting wages and cutting government services of one kind or another. And so austerity is the term that has been used to, I think, to refer to that idea that the only way to adjust is to trim and cut back. And you know, there's a very strong argument that supports that, that says, you know, it's a kind of no gain without pain argument, but somehow if you do make the right cuts, then somehow good things will eventually come your way, right? So okay, expansion is just around the corner. If you bite the bullet today, make the cuts, and everything will turn around. That's how austerity is usually sold, whether you're a Zambia or an Italy or a United States, right? Because it was, and this became particularly dominant everywhere after the global financial crisis, right? When government spending was required to right the economy, right? Because, you know, to rebalance the financial system, put banks and other financial institutions back in shape, and to kind of boost the private sector. I mean, governments had to spend it. The private sector was not in a position to spend, so governments had to spend to keep the economy going. And once that had happened, you know, governments had by of necessity acquired these large debts to do that. They couldn't do anything else. Tax revenues were collapsing because the economy was collapsing. So they had to borrow to do that. The immediate response of those people that had caused the crisis in the first place was, well, governments can't continue to doing this. These are major obstacles to a healthy kind of future growth performance. So we better cut back on government services, make sure that wages don't grow quickly so we can sell our stuff abroad competitively, et cetera. And that became the dominant mantra after the global financial crisis. But it, you know, it was a logic that had been imposed on many developing countries in the 1980s and the 1990s. So for us, it was a familiar kind of logic. And you're hearing it again already, right? I mean, you're beginning to hear that. You know, I think you're hearing it less. I mean, there is a stronger counter narrative this time around in response to COVID-19 that this is not the way to recover better. But you're beginning to hear it that you know, people, governments have already spent too much. Debt levels have already reached dangerous levels. Inflationary pressures around the corner. We better cut backs now if we're going to have a healthy economy over the rest of the decade. So you're already beginning to hear the austerity mantra emerging in response to the signs of recovery that we saw over the summer. That's beginning to change now because, you know, certainly in Europe, the economies are having to lock down again, and the danger of a double dip recession is looming. But, you know, this resort to austerity is the way in which neoliberal economies deal with adjustment problems, you know, or imbalances in their economy.
I was going to add really quickly. I didn't mean to say that. I wasn't trying to be insulting when I said that some people may hear austerity and think it sounds jargony, or they may be unfamiliar with that. I just think that a lot of people may be unfamiliar with the term, or they may hear it in passing, and you know. To me, there's like real ramifications to it that you talk about in the report. I mean, in a lot of ways, it means the cutting of social safety nets and, you know, increased government frugality, which also means decreased government spending.
Well, yeah, but also trying to keep a wraps on wages too. You know, it's not just government; it's also households that need to be subject to the pressure of frugality, because one of the arguments often you hear is that the only way that we can get out of this crisis if firms are able to sell their stuff on foreign, you know, abroad, on not export our way out of this crisis, and so you have to cut costs to be able to become competitive on international markets. So I mean, I think, you know, the biggest manifestation of this is obviously is often in terms of cuts in government services, government, social security, etc. But it's also linked, I mean, it's closely linked to that, is this idea of the need to keep wages down as being a necessary part of the adjustment process.
Now, in regards to tying this to the 08 crisis, why is it so important for us to look back at the 08 crisis as sort of a warning? Why do you address that in the report?
I think there are a couple of, I mean, one is because it didn't do what it said it would do on the can, right? I mean, it didn't deliver robust recovery. The last decade everywhere, essentially, with one or two exceptions, has been one of the slowest decades in terms of growth performance over the last 70 years. So it didn't deliver a strong, robust recovery, nor did it actually deliver government finances that were in better shape, because that's the other promise. You know, you had to cut back to get rid of the debt that governments had accumulated. And once you'd done that, again, you know, government, once you'd cut back on the high levels of government debt, nice things would begin to happen. But in fact, it didn't really cut back on government debt either, for the obvious reason that austerity doesn't just cut the spending side of things. Because it has an adverse consequence on growth and incomes, it cuts the source of revenue for governments too. Tax revenues decline to some extent, compounded often by governments themselves choosing to cut back corporate taxes as, again, part of this mantra that we need to be more competitive. Firms need to be leaner and have more room to be able to invest in the future. But, you know, so government revenues are hit at the same time as government spending with the austerity strategy. So it doesn't even deliver what it promises to deliver, which is more robust government balance sheets. So I mean, you know, it's a failed strategy. First, and the response to 2008, 2009, I think, demonstrates how it didn't fail, which is why we were so vulnerable today to this shock from a microscopic virus. I think the other point, though, that is also very important is that the 2008, 2009 crisis, I think, opened an opportunity both to rethink the neoliberal agenda, that somehow markets are the only and the best way to deliver prosperity, right, and stability, and so that ideology took a huge hit from the 2008-2009 crisis, and the shocking thing for us was that despite that record and despite the crisis itself being so damaging, neoliberalism managed to salvage itself out of 2008-2009. And if that happens again, you know, the ideological underpinnings survive, if austerity becomes the policy wisdom over the next decade, we're screwed. And not only because of the damage it will cause economically, but also because we cannot solve the environmental problems we face under a neoliberal austerity-driven ideology. So there's a second, you know, we need to think why neoliberalism survived after the 2008-2009, if we're not going to repeat those mistakes again. And I think the third point about why it's important to revisit the crisis is that, you know, we do live in this highly interdependent world, and we need effective international mechanisms that can coordinate and buttress national government efforts. That's particularly true for our constituency in the developing world that have all kinds of problems that really do require international support if they're going to be addressed. There was a moment when the G20 was essentially created in 2008, 2009, people like Gordon Brown and Sarkozy, Obama himself, they came up with a fairly impressive, fairly ambitious international response. But it petered out very quickly. You know, within a year, essentially, that kind of idea of a multilateral international kind of response to the crisis had essentially begun to lose traction. And so you have to ask why that was the case. And again, to insist that if we're going to find a genuine strategy post COVID-19 in which recovering better is more than just a convenient slogan, then we need these international mechanisms to support the national efforts, and particularly the efforts of developing countries, so everyone indeed can recover better and in an inclusive way. So it forces us, I think, looking at 2008, 2009, to take a serious look at the weaknesses of the multilateral system and the gaps and the asymmetries and the persistent biases that don't make it a system fit for purpose to do what it says it wants to do, you know, which is to deliver these a better recovery, a more inclusive recovery, one where everyone participates and benefits from strong economic growth.
So it's interesting. I'm going to read a sentence from the report. The world did not prepare for the COVID-19 pandemic as well as it could have, and the ethos that informed the response to the global financial crisis has something to do with that failure. So what is that ethos that led to a failed response, and how does it relate to COVID? I know that's a big question to unpack, but.
I think it goes back. I mean, you know, it's not simply an economic problem, this, right? There's a serious political problem at the heart of this. And, you know, one of the A lot of people, when they talk neoliberalism, they think of neoliberalism as a system that just is about removing the state from economic life and giving business more room to make profits when it wants, where it wants, and how it wants, right? But it's not quite like that. I mean, I think, and it's more insidious in a way than that. What has happened is that the state has actually been captured by powerful corporate interests, particularly financial, but not only financial interests. And the power of the state and the public sphere have been used, rather than to deliver public goods of one kind or another, to buttress the position of those who have already got to the top of the pile, and to both to reinforce that position and to push back against potential countervailing influences that want to kind of rebalance the system in a more inclusive fashion. So there's a real political problem, I think, at the heart of this challenge about the need to reclaim the state and to reclaim the public sector for what it needs to do, which is to deliver public policy and public goods, rather than to be used as a way of reinforcing private positions and private goods. And I think that is at the heart of the challenge about the recovery, the international level too. I think a lot of people, and in a funny way, the emergence of Trump, for example, in a very kind of crude and, I would argue, ultimately hypocritical way, was responding to that idea that the political system had been captured by small elites who were able to use political levers to reinforce their positions at the expense of, you know, everyday people. I mean, that notion of populism, I think, which a lot of people in the kind of, you know, the elite kind of frown upon, but, you know, is a real genuine concern, in my opinion. It's also true of the international sphere as well. It's not just a problem within countries. I think it's a problem about the rules of the game that structure relationships across countries. So, I think at the heart of this challenge is that political economy issue of, you know, where does power lie? How is it reproduced? Who is in a position to use that power to their own interests? Those are the big questions that we will have to answer if we're going to recover better from COVID-19.
So in terms of policy, first, I guess, what if we don't change the course of the neoliberal policies? Where does that lead us based on this report? For my listeners, how would you describe it? What do you think would be in store?
Well, I mean, we call it a lost decade. That's what we see. In typical kind of economist fashion, we offer a model of that kind of, if that kind of policy regime prevails, right? So you have austerity, you have further rounds of trade liberalization, NAFTA type arrangements or something worse than NAFTA, the reassertion of the power of finance as the driving force of the economy, which was what happened after 2008, 2009. So we offer a modeling of that for the global economy and countries within it. And, you know, as we do that using our model, what we will get is a further slowdown of economic growth, a persistently high levels of unemployment. I mean, variations of course across countries, but persistently high levels of unemployment, growing inequality as measured by further declines in the share of labor in total income, and fragile government balance sheets. So, you know, and in that world where an investment will not be a dynamic force, either in the private or the public sector. A lot of the money that a lot of the income that is generated will once again go into pumping up financial markets and create the kind of bubbles and busts that we've come to see as a familiar part of this hyper-globalized landscape. That will be repeated over the next decade. And in the context of households that are already under huge stress, right? Already highly indebted, already being subject to precarious employment contracts in the developing world, compounded by all kinds of other problems with an environmental crisis now. You know, by the end of this decade, that kind of response will leave us in a very, very precarious situation in both the advanced and the developing countries. So that's, you know, I mean, you know, we have a fairly scary story that we try and model in the report. But we offer what we think is a serious analysis of the kind of dynamics that follow from that. So that would be our kind of doomsday scenario, a repeating the mistakes of the last decade in an environment that is already more fragile than it was in 2008, 2009. And that's a very, very worrisome combination.
Well, especially too with, I guess, the climate crisis, the burgeoning and emerging climate crisis is a wild card in all of this as well, right?
Yeah, and in that, you know, yeah, yes, of course. I mean, and it's something that we tried to look at in last year's trade and development report. Yeah, and it does raise the issue, which I guess is a particularly topical one in the United States, of the idea of a Green New Deal. And in many respects, what we see as the alternative is a kind of Green New Deal option. I guess what has worried us about a lot of the Green New Deal discussion, say in the United States, is that it's very, very locally focused, right? It's very much focused on the United States. And there is very little appreciation of what it might mean for the rest of the world economy, and particularly developing countries within that. And our position is simple. You know, I hope that the US would move in that direction, but the US moving in that direction will not solve the climate problem, you know, because developing countries want to grow. They have to grow to be able to deliver the kind of demands of their own citizens and population. They have to grow. And if they grow in the wrong way, whatever the United States and Europe does, we're going to have huge environmental problems as a consequence. So you know, the real challenge around the Green New Deal, I mean, there are clearly real challenges of advancing it, as we've already seen in the United States. But there is an even bigger challenge, I think, about making of combining traditional development challenges. You know, alleviating poverty, diversifying your economy, mobilizing taxes, and building up, you know, effective, etc. All the old development challenges with the environmental challenge in developing countries, and making sure that they don't repeat the mistakes that the advanced economies made to get rich. You know, I mean, that was the basis on which today's advanced economies became wealthy. And for us, that means the advanced economies have a responsibility, both financial in terms of technology flows and other things, to support developing countries, not just to grow, but to grow in an environmentally sustainable manner.
Now, in regards to, none of this is predestined, as you point out in the report. This is a matter of policy choices. What are some of the policy choices that can be made to sort of, you know, not get us into another lost decade?
Yeah, I mean, this is where we get into the meat of the issue, if you like, JG. I mean, the first thing we insist on, we cannot resort to premature austerity, right? Governments need to keep spending at the required level until the private sector, households and firms, are themselves comfortable enough to pick up the spending baton. That's incredibly important, that governments keep spending, that we don't fixate on the rising levels of debt that implies, that we allow governments the instruments, fiscal and monetary, to be able to do that. So that's, I mean, that's incredibly important. That's one of the big lessons from 2008, 2009. But it's not just a simple question of spending. It's also important what we spend it on, right? I mean, that's very important. And that's where a lot of the politics will be. And obviously some of that spending we think has to be in the area of the green economy. I mean, it's going to be a public investment that solves this problem. It's not going to be private investment that solves the climate problem. It's going to be public investment. I mean, private investment will eventually have an important role. But if the public sector doesn't drive this, it's not going to happen. So public investment in different types of transportation systems that are more sustainable, arguably different types of food systems, given that agriculture is a major contributor to climate change. So we need to have that conversation about not just the scale of government spending, but what we need to spend it on. And that, of course, is in the light of the current crisis. You know, we have to talk about what people are now calling the care economy, as being a really significant part of a recovering better strategy in which public investment and spending on healthcare and well-being in all its dimensions is a central part of the way forward. So that focus on public spending, public investment, the right kind of investment to build resilience, I think is critical. That's clear to us. I think it's not enough, though. That's not enough. We need other types of policies to complement and direct that kind of strategy. For example, we need to talk industrial policy again, because, I mean, I think the kind of transformation that we're talking about at the environmental level, market prices won't do this. This is not incremental changes where relative price shifts can actually achieve what we want to achieve in the time we want to achieve them. That's not going to happen with the market mechanism. So industrial policy and the government using taxes and subsidies to shift the patterns of production and consumption is going to be important to this this strategy. That we've no doubt. And interestingly, it's being discussed again in the United States. Of course, it's being discussed often in the context of China, right? China uses industrial policy and China's the big threat now and the big enemy. So we better do what China does if we're gonna repel their technological and other threats that people in the Beltway seem to fixate about in your country. But interestingly for us, because for a long time, even as we pushed industrial policy as part of the development strategy, the neoliberal consensus dismissed us as being, relics of a bygone era, basically, right? That somehow industrial policy was what happened in the 19th or early 20th century, but it was no longer relevant to the late 20th, early 21st century. So industrial policy is coming back and we have to make sure it's used in the proper ways. Progressive taxation, if we're going to address inequality, as you said, we need a different type of tax system.
I was going to say, it seems like there's always big pushback against things like a wealth tax from some people, but I think it's a pretty fair thing to have.
Look, I mean, people are, and we talk about it a little bit in this report, people are now talking and warning about what they call the K-shaped recovery, right? That is, some people will be doing very nicely as other people fall behind, right? So lots of economists talk about a V-shaped economy as a quick bounce back, or a U-shaped economy where we move along, stagnate for a while and then recover. But people are already seeing the K-shaped recovery. Billionaires in the United States increased their wealth portfolios since the start of the pandemic by something like $850 billion. There's a level of obscenity there as people are being thrown out of their houses, as unemployment hits double digit figures, as families, feel incredibly pinched, and even the more so as the threat of government support runs out, that's the state of affairs, right? And so we need to tackle, any notion of recovering better, any notion that is worth it, it's the paper it's written on has to tackle that problem. And progressive taxation has historically been, you know, the way to do that. And that might include a wealth tax. It might include financial transaction taxes of one kind or another, including at the international level. Even if we went back to the tax structure that was okay with Richard Nixon, then we would be in a better world, right? I mean that's, you know, and it's incredible how rightward we've shifted when the tax structure that was okay with Nixon is somehow unacceptable in the 21st century. I mean, that's, to me, that's pretty shocking.
It's definitely something I think about a lot, how, you know, as you said, someone like Nixon wouldn't even be seen as being nearly as right wing as, you know, Republicans or even some Democrats maybe today. It's wild.
And I think and related to that, because we know that one of the major sources of inequality comes from the deregulation of financial markets and the explosion of these various types of financial institutions and transactions that you know have created very little in terms of productive wealth, but have created huge amounts of personal wealth, right? And re-regulating finance is critical to any sort of serious notion of recovering better. And I think the need to find far more public options, including public banks, right? You know, development banks, industrial banks need to be that which had a critical role in many countries in their successful development models. That needs to be revived, because, you know, the current financial system is simply not capable of mobilizing resources for kind of patient, long-term, productive public investments. It just doesn't do it, clearly. It's had 40 years to work this out and it hasn't done it. So I think most logical people would say, well, clearly this is not a system that's geared to doing that. And we need to have not just kind of tinkering at the edges, which you got with Dodd-Frank after 2008, 2009, but you need a wholesale root and branch rethinking of the way in which the financial system is organized, both at the national and, I would argue, and that's very important for our constituencies, at the international level, to be able to do this thing that everyone claims they want to do, which is to recover better and in a more resilient fashion. So all those kinds of elements now need to come together. And I think that's what the Green, you know, I do. That's how we interpret the idea of a Green New Deal.
I was going to say, in that regard, what do you make of the sort of resurgence or the emergence, I guess, of this idea of MMT or modern monetary theory? Whether you agree or disagree, I don't think what you propose in the report is necessarily in line with everything the MMT people say, but it's sort of come up as a pushback on a lot of neoliberal ideas.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the MMT people have shown that central banks can play a far, far bigger role in delivering a more expansionary and balanced economy than has been assumed, right, in over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. Of course, you know, for us, well, because when it comes to developing countries, you know, they don't have the degree, or they're much more subject to external pressures of one kind or another, and they don't have the kind of monetary autonomy that is required to be able to use those mechanisms in the way that I think MMT people expect or hope in advanced economies. So I mean, you have to be conscious, first of all, of the difference amongst countries. I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve is one animal, the Central Bank of Zambia is another animal, right? They're completely different. So that's an important thing. And I think it's also incredibly important to understand that the functional finance in a world in which the financial system itself is dysfunctional doesn't necessarily lead to good conclusions. And so the MMT, if you're going to talk MMT, you can't talk it independently of the need for very serious reform of the wider financial system. And I think there's a tendency often in MMT to assume that it's kind of panacea for a lot of problems that to me, you know, that by themselves don't make that much sense.
In regards to the new president here in the U.S., Joe Biden, he will be in office in January. You told me before we started recording that you're working on a piece with regards to policies that Biden may want to put in place. Could you tell my listeners a little bit more about that? Where do you think the Biden presidency should go? And I'm sorry for being so America-centric.
It's very much along the lines that we say. The U.S. economy, you know, is one of the economies where all the conditions are in place to be able to pursue the kind of policies that we're talking about, right? I mean, you know, the multipliers, the fiscal multipliers are healthy. The Federal Reserve is a tremendously powerful economic instrument. Levels of technological sophistication are a level that is requisite. Now, of course, you have a hugely dysfunctional political system, which is going to be Biden's problem. We know that in terms of whether if he wanted to, he could begin to implement the kinds of policies that we're talking about. That's a question that is beyond our remit in a way. It interests us mainly in the way in which that kind of agenda impacts on developing countries. Because, you know, we want a healthy American economy that is engaged with the world, that is not trying to impose itself on other particularly developing countries, but acts as a kind of lodestone for the rest of the world, which is what it's in a position to do. You know, China, all the talk of China, China is not in that position. China's still a developing country. It's still got many of the features of other developing countries. Its currency is not an internationally accepted currency in the way that the dollar is. It doesn't have the levels of technological sophistication that the US. It's still the case that America is pivotal to any sort of healthy global economy. Of that, there's no doubt in my mind. We want to see, the sad thing is that despite what has happened over the last few, I would argue, not just a problem with Trump, but the last few American administrations, you know, this was the understanding of the Roosevelt administration that established the Bretton Woods institutions. They understood that, you know, a healthy economy not only required a healthy global economy, not only required a healthy United States, but it required a United States that was willing to support an international system that delivered for all. I mean, that was central to the New Deal argument in back in 1944, 1945, and the U.S. has lost that spirit completely. You know, and that's true, and that's not just a Trump problem. I mean, everyone wants to blame Trump for all these problems. I know, and I'm not persuaded that Trump is sui generis in this respect.
Are deeply structural problems.
Yeah, they're deeply structural, we trace the roots of hyperglobalization to the decisions that people like Paul Volcker made back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, which was very clearly geared to making Wall Street the center of the new economic paradigm. That's what it was all about. And many of the problems that we have seen since in the global economy in general and for developing countries follow from that, you know. And so, you know, blaming everything on the Trump administration is just unpersuasive for many of us.
Before we close out, I wanted to quote real quickly. Roosevelt said, economic diseases are highly communicable. You quote that, and you also quote him saying in the opening address to the Bretton Woods conference that you mentioned, it follows, therefore, that the economic health of every country is a proper matter of concern to all its neighbors, near and distant. Only through a dynamic and soundly expanding world economy can the living standard of individual nations be advanced to levels which will permit a full realization of our hopes for the future. I'm just curious, how do we sort of get that message across and get that message out there that there is a relationship between all of us and all these different nations and this global economy that we live in?
I guess in a kind of perverse way, the COVID-19 has served as a fairly dramatic reminder of just how interdependent we are. I mean, I think it's done two things. I think it's done that. And I think it has served as a reminder that, you know, public challenges can only be properly addressed by effective public institutions. And that's true both nationally and internationally. Now, moving from that recognition to a sea change in the way in which public policy is designed and implemented is another thing, right? But at least COVID-19 has forced those discussions back on the agenda. Now, if you look at the communique, for example, of the G20 that met in Saudi Arabia last weekend, I mean, it's pitiful compared with the kind of scale of the problem that we're facing. It's pitiful compared with what Obama and Gordon Brown and Sarkozy were willing to do back in 2009, actually, even though the nature of the crisis is in many respects greater than it was back then. So there's a huge amount of, I don't want to be kind of Panglossian here or something, there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done, I think. But I think, I mean, COVID has kind of cast a very strong light on those existing conditions that clearly, I think, we all increasingly recognize will have to be addressed if we're going to do things better this time around. And that, you know, that includes my world, the multilateral, you know, I mean, the IMF, to some extent, we've been strongly critical, obviously, of the Washington-based institution because we think they were instrumental in pushing a neoliberal agenda for the last three decades on developing countries. But they've gone through important changes in response to the global financial crisis. They're much more open to recognizing the problem of inequality, of the climate challenge, and, you know, they come up with proposals that we would be quite happy endorsing in many cases. But, you know, how that plays out in a more political context, that's an ideological, and that's the world of ideas. It doesn't always translate very smoothly into the world of politics. And, you know, that's the issue right now.
I'm also glad you mentioned that real quick. I wanted to say, I think there's this idea that, you know, quote unquote, elites are, you know, monolithic in their views. I think you get that sometimes in the sort of American discourse from that sort of Trumpist side of the spectrum. And I feel like there's a lot of questioning of older norms when it comes to issues like inequity and neoliberalism. Now, I'm not sure that people are as trusting of the sort of Alan Greenspan style of thinking as they were, you know, a decade or two decades ago. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, Janet Yellen, who I guess will become your Treasury Secretary and someone, you know, I've seen in action at the IMFC, the International Monetary and Financial Committee at the IMF, you know, is someone who really takes very seriously the problems of employment creation, of inequality, the possibilities of using fiscal policy to address. I mean, you know, she's not a Wall Street person, you know, in the way that Mnuchin was a product of Goldman Sachs, right? So, I mean, so I think, you know, there's reasons to be encouraged by having someone like Yellen as the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and you're right. You know, I mean, there is a diversity of opinion. I guess, you know, we don't just live in a world of ideas, though. We live in a world of interests too, and some of those interests, you know, will do a lot to retain the status quo, and because they do very nicely out of the status quo. And so, you know, we're always encouraged by you know, I mean, we've begun quoting the Financial Times extensively, you know, as I do in the report, because, you know, they're saying things now that we've been saying for the last 20 years about the need for taboo breaking policies, about the need to reject the last 30 to 40 years of simple neoliberal solutions to problems, about bringing the state back in. You know, I mean, so the paper of international big business is also, you know, making important changes. So it's not a monolithic, I think, you know, but ultimately the challenge is translating more radical or bolder ideas into policy practice. And that goes through interest groups. And in the case of the United States, you know, where lobbying and the power of money is particularly important, that can be a difficult nut to crack, right? So, you know, for me, I think, and this is, you know, one of the things, I mean, a lot of the, you know, talking modern monetary theory or the importance of a basic income or the role of industrial policy, which was taboo 20 years ago. I can tell you that no one would talk about this stuff 20 years ago, you know, at all. That's now part of the policy discussion, and that's got to be seen as a good thing. The challenge now is whether that kind of sensible discourse can actually translate into effective policymaking. And that's where the challenge, I think, lies right now.
In closing, with regards to this report and the proposals made, do you think there is hope to go against the sort of status quo interests and, you know, push things in the right direction through various interest groups and social movements?
Yeah, I mean, cautiously optimistic. As I said, we've seen these changes. We've seen the importance of movements like Black Lives Matter, even the Green New Deal, which is an idea that was hatched a decade ago, actually, after at the time of the global financial crisis. A bunch of economists in the UK began to talk about the need for a Green New Deal to recover from the 2008-2009 crisis. That died a death very quickly as austerity took hold. My impression is that the Green New Deal, and it's not just a US thing anymore. I mean, we as we've tried to push that kind of argument more generally, you know, we find people, it resonates with people, you know, including in developing countries. And there are movements behind that. There are social movements behind that. Trade unions are now talking about what a just transition is all about, because, you know, they have their concerns about shifting to a low carbon future at certain sectors of the economy. But it's now part of the discussion amongst trade. So there are, I think, groups now in place that are in a position to be able to push for these kinds of policies. But, you know, it's going to be a struggle. I mean, don't underestimate the power of capital, and particularly footloose capital. It's there. It's not going to roll over and put its legs in the air and hope you're going to scratch its tummy. That's not what capital does, you know. And so there are serious challenges there that will have to be faced if we're going to kind of deliver on this kind of agenda. And, you know, we would, and as we tried to argue in the report, the alternative is pretty frightening.
Do you think that alternative is almost feels like a doomsday scenario?
Look, I mean, you know, if you buy into the science, right, of climate change, right, it is a doomsday scenario, right? We can argue about whether it's 10 or 15 years that we really need to make this fundamental change, but that's a detail fundamentally. I mean, we won't make that kind of change if we go back to business as usual in 10 or 15 or 20 years. So that's one set of concerns. And I think, you know, and to some extent, the last 4 years in America reflects that. You know, there's a the corrosive consequences of a world that is becoming more unequal, corrosive politically, corrosive socially, you know, is frightening. And, you know, and we've seen the rise of extreme right-wing politics on the back of this growth of hyper inequality. And you combine hyper inequality with environmental breakdown, and that's a fairly scary combination, I think, that we that we're looking at. I mean, you know, the point, as you made out, that, you know, it's not inevitable. It will be the consequence of political and policy choices that drive us in that direction, just as it will be political and policy choices that forge an alternative. Right? Tomorrow begins today. Was Mary Wollstonecraft's kind of comment, the author of Frankenstein, right? So it's a, you know, tomorrow begins today. It's what happens. It's what we do now that will determine the future in 10 or 15 years.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I want to thank you, Richard Kozel Wright, for coming on Parallax Views. I found this to be a very enlightening conversation, and I highly recommend people read the UNCTAD report. I will be posting it on the show notes. Is there anything I missed that you think my listeners should really consider with regards to this report?
No, I mean, I would say that, you know, this is, as I said, this report builds on a series of reports that we've been working on over the last 4 or 5 years. And so people can not only, I mean, and these are a genuine public good. You can download these for free from the UNCTAD website. So they're there to be consumed for free. And it's not, I have a vested interest, but, you know, the reports, I think, that we've been working on for the last 4 or 5 years very much provide a kind of further depth and detail to the arguments that are present in this year's report.
Thank you again, Richard Kozel Wright, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you, JG. It's a pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Richard Kozel Wright of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. I think it was a very important conversation, and I highly recommend reading the 2020 UNCTAD report, From Global Pandemic to Prosperity. In fact, I'd say that it is more than necessary reading. It is vital reading if you're keeping up on current events and policy, not only in America, but around the world. So please give that a read. I should include that in the show notes. And as always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email @ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, Chase, and our newest $10 subscriber, Holland. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then join the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon page at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. That's patreon.com/ParallaxViews. If you want, you can also join the $5 tier, where you will get archived editions of previous Parallax Views programs, as well as the bonus show, The Week That Was, It's a bit irregularly scheduled at this point due to some scheduling issues with my co-host Casey, but we hope to get back on track very soon. You know how the holiday season is. Also, $15 tier subscribers, I will be doing not one, but two Zoom or Skype sessions with listeners next month to make up for the lack of Zoom and Skype sessions this month. It was a bit hectic due to the turkey dinner this month, Thanksgiving, so I was not able to get the group Zoom Skype session in, but rest assured, we will fix that next month with not one, but two Zoom or Skype sessions with listeners who subscribe at the $15 tier. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.